Just looking at the Bible in the Old Testament specifically, I'll begin here. The Old Testament suggests that really Israel, when we think of Israelite religion, how they worshiped God, what do we think of? Because we really can look in the Old Testament and realize about three stages of the way they worshiped. And it's not necessarily something God laid out in advance. It's just what we see. And what do we mean three stages? Well, here's what I mean. When we think of Old Testament worship, starting at Mount Sinai, when the law of Moses is given, and when God told them to worship, what did He give them? What do we visualize? What do we see when they're worshiping God? We probably think of the tabernacle, don't we? The tents that they could carry with them, which had the presence of God. You had the tabernacle and going with them. When they conquered the land and settled, it was set up at Shiloh, or Shiloh, however we wish to pronounce it over here, at Shiloh. And that was sort of Israel's first capital city, in a sense. Shiloh wasn't a big city. It was a Canaanite city originally. But the tabernacle was set up there, in the middle of the country, in the territory of Ephraim, Joshua's tribe. And maybe that helps to explain a little bit of why in the Judges, Ephraim considers themselves pretty important. They get offended easily if not included in military operations. They got upset at Jephthah one time, and they got upset at Gideon, I think, before that, for not including them in the way, and they felt a little dishonored. At one point, they even fought a civil war, and maybe some of that comes from the tribe of Joshua the Conqueror. Maybe some of it is also because we have the tabernacle in our tribe. But we see the tabernacle there and the high priestly line, descendants of Aaron, the altar, the Ark of the Covenant, all of that in the tabernacle at Shiloh from the time they inhabit the land around the early 14th century B.C. until the time of Eli, which actually there's a typo. It should be the early 11th century B.C., not the 12th century. Those computer viruses just have a way of putting typos in there, don't they? Yes, but for some 300 years, the tabernacle at Shiloh is the center of their worship. And that is really what I like to call the first stage. The second stage, what's that? Well, the tabernacle didn't always stick around there. Because at the end of Eli's life, Eli the high priest, Samuel's a young boy, what happened when Eli died? What were the events going on when Eli died? It was a pretty violent time. The tabernacle appears to have been destroyed. And that happened. The Bible talks about it indirectly. But we may remember that the Israelites fought the Philistines. And the Ark of the Covenant was captured. Eli's sons carried it out to the field of battle as sort of maybe a good luck charm or a religious charm. They figured that would give them an advantage. It didn't work. And it was captured by the Philistines, carried off to Philistia. Eli's sons, the next generation of the high priest, they were killed. And Eli himself, when he heard the news, he falls over and breaks his neck and dies. And so that's quite a disaster. The high priest is the closest thing Israel has to a dynastic ruler, a family-based influential ruler of some kind. The judges didn't, pass on their authority from father to son. That's not the way it worked. And they had no king yet. And so the closest thing to that, two generations just perished, Eli and his sons. And the ark was captured. And the Bible doesn't say it specifically, but there are references later on in Jeremiah to this, that the city of Shiloh was destroyed by the Philistines after this. Because after this happens, when Eli dies, the tabernacle ceases to be mentioned. And Shiloh, ceases to be mentioned. What happened? When the Ark of the Covenant is brought back, when the Philistines returned it, the Israelites didn't take it back to Shiloh. They didn't take it back to the tabernacle. They took it to someone's house in a different city, and it stayed there. Why didn't they take it to the tabernacle? It appears the tabernacle was destroyed by the Philistines after they captured the Ark. And later on, as I mentioned, there are references. Look at what I did to Shiloh. I'm going to do that to my house in Jerusalem if you don't repent. So that's the second stage. The tabernacle's gone. And the worship is no longer there anymore. The Ark of the Covenant is in someone's house in one city. We find the priests in a couple of different cities at different times. we find the altar of sacrifice at the city of Gibeon, the city that deceived Joshua early on. We find the altar there. In fact, before Solomon builds the temple, Solomon is offering sacrifices at Gibeon. Why not in Jerusalem? Why not at Shiloh? Because the altar wasn't there yet. So it's things are scattered. And we even see hints that religious locations were kind of being blended with private property. And there are examples of that. We'll see in just a second. The third stage is a pretty logical one. Solomon built the temple, and everything came back together again in Jerusalem. The ark is there. The temple is there. The priests are there. The altar is there. And so that continues on until the destruction by Babylon. And then after the captivity, it comes back together again. The ark wasn't there. It disappears. But everything else is there up to the time of Jesus. But we see these stages here, and God didn't say, okay, now I want you to have a second stage. That's not the way it worked. It's just what happened. They disobeyed. The ark was captured. Tabernacles destroyed. And things were just in a bad state. And then they come back together again finally in Solomon's time. But in the third stage, we had this division of the kingdom later and the golden calves, and that was a variation, an unlawful variation, that continued up through the destruction of Israel. And so that's what we see in the Bible, and the archaeology kind of bears that out, at least in places we're allowed to dig. We can't dig on the Temple Mount. It's Muslim holy ground today, and we'd start a new world war if we're not having one already. And so we just don't dig there. We can't, look at anything. We can look at other places like Gibeon or Shiloh and places like that and find evidence that illuminates some of these things. But I mentioned that in the second stage that we see indications that religious locations and private property kind of get blended. See, in the tabernacle, was the tabernacle also like where the priest hung out and lived? No. No, it was not. It was only for worship. The tabernacle was entirely a religious location. No one lived inside the tent except the Lord. But look at what we find several hundred years later, just before the tabernacle is destroyed. In 1 Samuel chapter 3, starting in verse 1. The boy Samuel, he's been given to Eli to be raised there, he was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli. At that time, Eli, whose eyesight had begun to grow dim so that he couldn't see, was lying down in his own place. Samuel was lying down where? In the temple of the Lord, where the ark of God was. That's the tabernacle. They used the word temple, but it's the tabernacle still, though it may have been replaced in part by some other kind of structure, because earlier it mentions that Eli was sitting at the doorpost of the house of the Lord. And later on, Samuel's opening the doors of the house of the Lord. The tent didn't have doors or doorposts, so maybe, the tent has been replaced by other kinds of materials along the way. Sort of a deterioration of the original arrangements that God had put in place. And the little boy Samuel, he's asleep in the same place where the Ark of the Covenant is. That's curious. And it's not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing, it's just a thing. But that's what the Bible tells us. The Lord called Samuel that night. Samuel, and Samuel responded thinking it's Eli. So Eli is not too far away either. Maybe he's on the other side of the wall or something like that. Doesn't really get specific enough, but Samuel thinks it's Eli. He runs to him, and Eli says, "No, it wasn't me. Go back to sleep." It happens a couple of more times. Then Eli realizes the Lord must be calling him and gives Samuel instructions on how to respond the next time. And that's when Samuel was first called as a prophet. And it goes on from there. But we see a little detail. Samuel's lying down in the same place as the Ark of the Covenant. And that's just before the tabernacle is destroyed. But a hint that religious and private spaces are getting mixed. After 300 years, things slowly decline, deteriorate, and that's where we find things. And we look later on, I mentioned that the Ark was captured and brought back. When it was brought back, when it was sent back by the Philistines, they didn't bring it to the tabernacle. Where did they take it? 1 Samuel 7, verse 1. The men of another city, Kiriath Jearim, it's a long ways south of Shiloh, about 15 miles west of Jerusalem. People from that city came and took the Ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of a guy, Abinadab, on the hill. From the day that the Ark was lodged there, a long time passed, some 20 years. The ark's not in the tabernacle, it's at someone's house. And he put it in someone's room, and one of his sons was appointed and consecrated to take care of the ark. So we have, again, sort of a mixing of sacred space where the ark dwells, where the presence of God dwells, in one room of someone's house. And we have it again in 2 Samuel 6. David is bringing the ark to Jerusalem. He has a new tent set up there, bringing the ark there. And the first time it doesn't go very well, he puts it on a cart, and the oxen stumble, and a guy touches it to steady it, Uzzah, and he dies. Well, after that happens, David, you know, let's hold off. Don't bring it up there. And so where did David put it? In someone else's house, in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. And the ark remained in his house for 3 months. So it's a curious thing. The ark is no longer, at least at this point, between the destruction of the tabernacle and the building of the temple. The ark has a pattern of being in one room of someone's house. A room in someone's house is now sacred space, and the rest of the house is not sacred space. There's no longer just a dedicated building or a dedicated tent, at least some of the time, entirely dedicated only to sacred things. And that's a curious thing, and we find that in some of the archaeology I'm going to show you in just a moment. The first site I worked in Israel, starting in 2009, it's located where David fought Goliath. In fact, in this photo, the valley behind there, you see a hill and then a valley in front of it, that's where David killed Goliath. And that hill back there is the Philistine side. There's enough detail in 1 Samuel 17, we know exactly where it happened. This is one of the rooms of a city that we've excavated for a number of years. We finished in 2013. This city overlooks the battlefield, and it's basically the place where Saul's base camp was during that story. But this room you see behind me here, that room turned out to be a religious room. But it's curious, we call it a cultic room. In archaeology speak, cultic means religious. I don't know why they don't just say religious, they say cultic. So, okay, fine, go ahead. And you kind of get into the pattern of, you know, using those terms yourself after a while, it rubs off on you. So when I say cultic, I don't mean a cult, I mean religious. This is a religious room. You see a little stone standing there by itself. That is a religious standing stone. We find examples of that in the Bible. Sometimes they were to memorialize something, like Samuel putting up that stone he called Ebenezer. And Jacob set up a standing stone after he had the dream with the ladder, with the angels going up and down. The standing stones were also used to represent a god or an idol sometimes. And that use was prohibited in the law of Moses. But we find a standing stone, that's the way we found it. When we moved all the dirt away and cleared out the room and uncovered everything, that stone up there, that's a religious standing stone. And we have a little basin right there. We have a bench along the wall for worshipers to sit. We have a couple of things. Maybe it held water or maybe a fire pit of some kind. And we found other objects in that room that were religious. This is a religious room. But it's interesting. This room is not, it's just one room in a building with about 8 or 9 other rooms. This is the only room that had anything religious in it. The other rooms were normal household stuff, nothing religious about them at all. This room dates from the time period between the destruction of the tabernacle and the building of the temple. The same time period as David, actually, Saul and David. So when we have the Ark of the Covenant in someone's house, when we have Samuel sleeping where the Ark is, this city, this room, dates to exactly the same time period. And we find that same feature going on here. One room is religious, the rest of the building is not. Interesting, isn't it? And how do we know that room is religious? This is one of the big indicators. We have that standing stone and representing a god, maybe representing the God of Israel. Sometimes that the golden calves, many believe the golden calves are not a separate god, but a way to represent the God of Israel through an image of some kind. That's why we have in the Ten Commandments, you know, we have no other gods before me, but what's the next one? Don't make unto me any graven images. Don't worship God through an image. And that might include a stone of some kind. Some of these stones were cut and even have images on them. This one doesn't. So at least they're observing the ban on depictions of people or animals. But we also have in front of it this flat stone right here, which is basically an offering table. You offer whatever you're offering, and that's where you do it, in this room. We also found some other things. We found this very curious-looking piece called a libation vessel. It's for drink offerings. And we're going to talk more about that in just a second, a very distinct shape, but that's a religious object. We've only found 3 of these kinds of vessels in all of Canaan. 2 of them came from this city. And so here's one of the 3 we've ever found anywhere in the history of archaeology in Canaan. a drink offering vessel, a libation vessel. And we also found a little altar, maybe for burning incense there. And we see it's decorated with little door frames right here, which is a religious feature on temples and things representing temples. Palm tree fronds represented there, which we find on other kinds of altars and religious things as well. In fact, we had palm trees depicted inside Solomon's temple. Some of the decorations in there, cherubim and palm trees. And so that's a common thing, even with Israelite religion. We see that in the Bible. And we found a lot of weapons. There's three big ones in the middle, the three swords. They were found in another religious room at the site, another building where one room's religious and the rest of them aren't. But that's curious because swords in a religious room, we find that in the Bible as well in this very same time period that the city dates to. Look here, David's fleeing Saul. And he runs away and goes up to where the priests are at that moment, a city called Nob. Why aren't they with the tabernacle or with the Ark of the Covenant in the other city? They're not for some reason still. But he goes up there and says, do you have any food? Do you have any weapons? And the high priest gave David the holy bread, the bread of the presence, which was there with the priests. And he also said, do you have a spear or a sword? Well, all we have here is a sword of Goliath. And it's back there wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. What's the ephod? Part of the high priest's vestments. They have weapons stored in a place with sacred clothes, the high priest's clothes. Why? I don't know, but we found these three big swords right there in the middle in one of the sacred rooms at this city. So we have the very same kind of thing going on. This is the second stage here. We see when the tabernacle's gone and we have the ark and the mixing of sacred and public spaces and weapons being stored in religious rooms. And we found that in this place where I was digging for 5 years as well. So it illuminates and confirms these curious details were in fact going on in this time period before Solomon built the temple. Don't know why, but it's interesting that the Bible is accurate in those kinds of details for this specific time period. If it's accurate in those things, what else is it accurate with? How much more reason do we have to put faith in the Bible when these little insignificant, obscure details turn out to show up in the archaeology of that period? So let's come back to this libation vessel thing. There's the photo, one of the two that we found. Here is the third one that we found in a different site called Tel Kiri. But look inside it. How does it work for drink offerings? This is the key this morning. You see, it has two openings at the top, one handle, two openings. It's hollow inside. So you can pour a liquid in one side and pour it out the other side. That appears to be how you did it. And so when you're making an offering, you take your vessel and maybe you pour whatever drink offering you have in one side. Maybe you bless it or wave it or something, whatever the priest would do, and then pour it out the other side over your offering. That appears to be the way it works. That would explain the second opening and how it's empty inside and you can, you know, one side or the other. But all this connects to something that Paul wrote in 2 Timothy 4. What's the point of all this? Just to see how neat the Bible is in its details and archaeology? The real point is this verse right here and others like it. But this is Paul's last letter. And what did Paul write in his 2 Timothy 4, verse 6? When he's giving his own eulogy, I suppose. I'm already being poured out as a drink offering. And the time of my departure has come. I think many of us have read this verse before. We're familiar with it. The time of his departure has come. He's anticipating his death. But look at what he's comparing himself to. A drink offering. It struck me one time, that's of all the things to compare yourself to or to use as an analogy for your life or your purpose, why not just say a sacrifice? I've sacrificed as my Lord has. The Lord was a lamb and, you know, I've tried to be a lamb myself and sacrifice myself for others. That's not what he says. He picks out a drink offering. How does he describe his life? I am a drink offering. Okay, Paul. That's a very random thing to choose. A drink offering? What is a drink offering? Very popular in the Bible, in the Old Testament. But why didn't he pick something just more generic, more common? A sacrifice in general. Why a drink offering? Well, let's read up on these. They're called libations in some translations. A libation or a drink offering. Different translations, you know, use one term or the other. But in Exodus 29, here's one example. Give instructions on one of the sacrifices. This is what you'll offer on the altar, the Lord said. two lambs a year old, with the first lamb, you know, fine flour mingled with a, you know, beaten olive oil, and a fourth of a hin of wine for a drink offering. So in this case, a drink offering is, what do we call it, like one of the components of a proper sacrifice. You have, of course, your wood, you have, you know, your lamb and, you know, some flour that's been ground up, and you add, in this case, some wine. And that's one part of the proper sacrifice. You don't just, you know, throw the wood on, throw the animal on, light the fire. You add a drink offering as well. And this is not the only place we find it. We find it, in fact, throughout the Law of Moses. Here are a few examples. Leviticus 23, a couple of examples. Numbers 28, grain offerings with their drink offerings, a food offering with a pleasant aroma. And we see in verse 37 of Leviticus 23, you know, different kinds of, including drink offerings there. Numbers 28, their drink offering shall be this much wine for a bull, this much for a ram, a different amount for a lamb. But we see that sacrifices, it's a pretty standard thing. A libation, a drink offering, it's a part of a scriptural sacrifice. And look at the description of the tabernacle in Numbers chapter 4. What's inside the tabernacle? You have the ark, you have the lampstand, you also have a table with the bread of the presence. And what does it have on it? Over the table of the bread of the presence, a cloth of blue, a blue tablecloth, put on it plates, dishes for incense, bowls, the flagons for the drink offering, and the showbread, 12 unleavened loaves that was changed out weekly. Now, I always picture the bread of the presence as just having the bread. It had a lot of hardware on it too, didn't it? Including these little vessels for drink offerings. So something that looks like what we saw in one way or another. That was inside the tabernacle on the table. Drink offerings were very popular in the Law of Moses. And so we see something like this, more or less, on the table inside the tabernacle next to the unleavened bread. So, here's a question. Why were drink offerings a part of every sacrifice? Why don't we have the wood, we have the animal. Why does almost every sacrifice have a drink offering included? And the Bible describes it typically as something alcoholic. Wine or strong drink. Some other kind of alcoholic drink of some kind. Why? I don't think there's a verse that just says, here is why you have drink offerings. But Paul uses that component to describe his work. What is it about a drink offering that Paul related to? Well, let's think about it a little bit. And we have, you know, more examples here, Numbers 28, and we can keep going. You know, so many examples. But I think that really we can sum it up like this, at least one part of it. We talk about offerings being a pleasant aroma to the Lord, and maybe the drink offerings, maybe some of the aroma of the wine, maybe mixed with that, it was a part of it. But I think also that the drink offerings, they're always alcoholic. And maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe they stimulated the sacrifices in some way. And here's maybe one way to think about it. You ever tried to grill out and just couldn't get the fire going? What do we do if we're using charcoal? What do we add? We add a drink offering of lighter fluid, don't we? And this is not what it would have looked like back then, you know, but, you know, you get enough and you can, you know, have quite the sacrifice going on there, right? But I think this may be a part of it. Paul wrote, I'm poured out as a drink offering. The time of my departure has come. What's he saying? What is it about his work, his service, that's a drink offering? Maybe he's saying that he is stimulating people's sacrifices. Look at Philippians chapter 2. He says the same thing in verse 17. I am to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith. What's he saying there? He uses again this drink offering term. It's not just in Timothy. To the Philippians, the very same idea. What is he saying? You know, we don't do sacrifices today, so we don't really, you know, relate to it in the same way. So, he says again, I'm poured out as a drink offering upon your sacrifice. I think it means that he's stimulating, helping to fuel, helping to augment, to make possible even, other people's offerings. Imagine if it's raining, and you're a priest in the temple, and it's Passover, or the Day of Atonement, or whatever, and it's raining, and your wood's all wet. How do you get your sacrifice lit? Maybe some alcohol will help counteract the rain so you can worship properly. Maybe something about that is connected with this drink offering. A drink offering helps make the fire possible, especially if conditions are bad. That may just make the difference between your fire lighting and not lighting. What did Paul do? He's poured out on other people's sacrifices, their faithful works. He is a drink offering on that. I think he's saying there that he wanted to help fuel their sacrifices. It's not just the wood. The drink offering maybe can be a part of that. He is making other people's sacrifices possible. He stimulated his brethren. He stimulated the service of other Christians. And we think about that, that's a profound point. He describes his life as stimulating other people's service, making their fires better, making their fires possible. Wow. Do we relate to that? We think of Paul as going around and, you know, sacrificing himself, sacrificing his life, sacrificing his time, and he did. But he writes about himself multiple times as not really the sacrifice himself, but something stimulating and fueling other people's sacrifices. That's the secret. That's his key. That's the code he lives by. That's how he describes his life at the very end. How shall I describe my life? I'm a drink offering. And that is profound. Peter uses the same kind of point, doesn't use the term drink offering, but look what Peter writes in 2 Peter 1 verse 13. I think it right, as long as I'm in this body, to stir you up by way of reminder. Stirring people up, reminding them, stimulating them to continue, encouraging them, exhorting them. That's a drink offering. Different words, same idea. And how about Jesus himself? Just before the lesson, we read Luke chapter 22. There's a verse in there, there's a word in there that connects all of this with a drink offering. What did Jesus say in verse 20? This cup that is poured out for you, poured out is the new covenant of my blood. Look at that word. What verb is in there? Poured out. Poured out. That's your drink offering verb. The libation verb. And what is the libation Jesus poured? His own blood. Would our sacrifices, be possible without the blood of Jesus? No. Is it possible for you and for me to offer acceptable sacrifices without the drink offering of Jesus' blood? No. Jesus is using the very same example. He's curious of all the things, you know, I'm the lamb, but he makes his blood the drink offering. He makes sure to add that in there. It is the drink offering poured out, and his blood is the libation, the drink offering, that makes our sacrifices possible at all. And so Jesus uses the very same image as Paul does in Luke chapter 22. It's right there. It has been the whole time. What's the point for us? God wants our drink offerings, our libations, to ignite, to fuel, to better the sacrifices of others. And we find this point, this principle, throughout the New Testament. And it's, in fact, a key part of Christian work, Christian service. Hebrews 3 verse 13, what's the writer say? Exhort one another every day. What is that? Stirring up, stimulating the offerings of other people. I shouldn't just focus on my own sacrifice. Am I sacrificing like I should? Am I being, am I offering myself up to God as I should? That's an important question to ask and even more important to answer. But that's not the end of it. Well, I'm doing what I should do. All that matters is my relationship with Jesus. No, that's not all that matters. If all that matters is my personal relationship with the Lord, I'm forgetting the whole drink offering part. My sacrifice is incomplete. It's not an acceptable, complete sacrifice to God. A drink offering isn't focused on its own sacrifice. It's focused on being part of another sacrifice. Jesus didn't just focus on his own sacrifice. He poured out his blood to make our sacrifices possible. Paul is a drink offering. He was a drink offering. He didn't simply go and baptize. In fact, he makes a point in Corinthians that he didn't just go baptizing all the time. You look at his missionary journeys. Most of the time, he's not establishing new churches, at least a lot of the time. A lot of his journeys are spent going to existing churches to pour his drink offering on them and get them fueled again. Stimulate them to keep going while he can't be there. That is our job. And if I'm focused so much on my personal relationship that I'm not thinking of others, I have a very selfish, limited, incomplete sacrifice. Paul, Peter, Jesus himself teach us, even the old law of Moses, why were drink offerings a part of it? They're trying to teach us how to sacrifice, how to serve. And exhort one another that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. He's counting on our drink offerings, our exhortations, our encouragement, our stimulation to help keep each other straight. And how about Hebrews 10, a very famous verse. I almost hesitate to mention it because let's look at it from a point of a drink offering. Let's consider how to stir up one another to love and good works. That sounds like a drink offering, doesn't it? Not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another. Drink offering, libations, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. Why do we assemble together? It's not to sit in the pews. It's not out of guilt over this verse. Don't forsake the assembly. The reason we assemble together is to fuel each other. And is my purpose in coming here to help fuel somebody? Or am I just coming here for my own fuel? It's good to come here for my own fuel to hopefully have others pouring their libations over my sacrifice, others helping my sacrifice, my offering to be better. But am I looking to help someone else with their sacrifice? If not, how good can my sacrifice really be? You know, the purpose is to come and to stimulate and be stimulated with as Christians. Look at this specific instruction. It's under the same aegis as this, as the point about drink offering. Titus 2:3-4. Older women are to teach what's good, train the young women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled, pure, working at home, kind, submissive to their own husbands. This is a drink offering in detail. Same thing. And there are other instructions for other people as well. It's not limited to simply some of the women. 1 Thessalonians 5:11. Encourage one another. Build one another up just as you're doing. That's drink offering work. Verse 14, we urge you, brothers, admonish the idle, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with them all. Keep fueling and helping others' sacrifices. Make their sacrifices better. Keep their fires going. Don't let them be burned out. Philippians 2:5-7, talking about Jesus again. And we have a drink offering verb again. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus. Though he was in the form of God, he did not count equality as God as a thing to be grasped. But what did he do? He emptied himself. There's our drink offering verb. Pouring himself out. Taking the form of a servant. Jesus showed us how to do it. The law of Moses taught God's people the value and the role of a drink offering. Jesus showed us how to do it. Paul, Peter, they tell us how to do it. Mark 10:45, Jesus says it again. In other words, even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, to give his life for many. Jesus was a libation for us. He lived the drink offering. He showed us what it's all about. He fulfilled the prophecy of drink offerings. The old law's a prophecy, really, isn't it? Passover is a prophecy. Sacrifices were prophecies. The drink offering was a prophecy teaching us how to be Christians. And it keeps coming up over and over again in the New Testament. Are you and I libations? Are we fueling others? Is someone here this morning weak and struggling? What do we usually do when we're weak and struggling? What's the mistake we so often make? We pull back. We spend less time with Christians because we're discouraged. We pull back. Do you want to die? If I want to die, then I should pull back and let my flame be extinguished. Do you want to live? Are you struggling? Are you weak? Are you discouraged? Okay, after answering that, if you answer a yes, do you want to live? Or do you want to die? If you want to die, pull back and don't let anyone fuel your sacrifice. If you want to live, put yourself around other Christians and let them get your flame going again. Let those drink offerings do their job. And it just so happens, when we fuel other people's sacrifices, the fires are bigger all around. It might help with that discouragement. Do you want to live? Let those drink offerings keep you alive. Don't let your fire die out. If you pull away from God's people, if I pull away from God's people, I have only myself to blame, really. God put fuel there for us when we need it. And I just step back and refuse to let it come on my heart. We're to be libations and to benefit from being libations. Drink offerings. That little odd-shaped jar helps remind us so much of what Paul and Peter and the Lord himself tell us. Thank you for your kind attention.